I'd like to call this meeting, three, two, one. I'd like to call this meeting of the House Resources Committee to order at 6 minutes after 1 o'clock on Monday, April 7th, 2014. Present with us today is a full House, Representative Johnson, Representative Kawasaki, Representative Hawker, Vice Chair Wilson, Co-Chair Feige, Representative Olson, Representative Tarr, Representative Seaton, and myself, Co-Chair Sadler. Seeing no one else in the House, encourage you all to turn off your phones. And we do have four items on today's agenda. First off, we're going to do the Board of Game Confirmations. I'd like to rule the next House Bill 371, State Land and Materials, down to the bottom of the committee calendar for today. Or there might be a lot of folks who want to testify publicly and want to preserve time in the committee's schedule to address the next two bills, SB 77, Big Game Hunting with Children, not for children, and SB 137, Extending the Seismic Hazards Safety Commission. So that will do the Board of Game. And what I'd like to do also is to hold public comment from remote areas. My experience has been that lots of folks want to comment on each of the appointees, and I think to expedite and make it a little simpler, we'll hear each of the board nominees' presentations, committee questions, and then we'll go to public testimony. With that, I would invite David Brown, who's calling in from Wrangell, to give us his name on the record. If you can hear me, give us a brief summary of your qualifications, Mr. Brown, and tell the committee why you'd like to serve on this August board.
Okay, can you hear me?
We hear you. Maybe a little closer to the mic.
Okay.
Just make sure you give us your name for the record.
This is David Brown. I'm from Wrangell. I have been here for 32 years. I was a teacher for 30 years and now retired. I have a wife who is also a teacher and three grown children. I'm an avid hunter and trapper, commercial crab fisherman. I'm a member of the NRA, Hope and Young, Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation. I've been a hunter ed instructor for archery. First of all, I'd like to thank Governor Parnell for appointing me.
Mr. Brown, there's somebody who's rattling papers or something on a desk, so if you could make sure and keep your hands still so we can hear Mr. Brown.
I'm interested in serving on the board for a couple reasons. I want to see Alaska wildlife be used in a sustainable manner, maximum hunting opportunity for all. I want to become part of the process. Now that I'm retired, I have time to do that, do some public service. I'm an advocate of fair chase hunting and sportsmanship. I guess that's it.
Okay. And you have time in your schedule as a retiree to attend the meetings and all the AGs, the advisory committees and so forth?
Yes, I do.
Very good.
Pretty flexible now.
Okay, thanks. Good to thank you, Mr. Brown. Are there questions from the committee for Mr. Brown? Representative Wilson of Wrangell.
Hi, Dave. This is Peggy. And good to have you as one of the candidates. And I think it would be nice if you could share with the committee some of the things that came up and that happened when you were teaching archery.
I guess I'm not real sure what you're looking for.
Well, what some of the things that you thought that you, because I know you taught good sportsmanship as far as both with the game and the people that were doing the hunting, and I think you passed that on to a lot of students. So,
right. Well, I guess, I mean, not only when I taught archery classes, but just in being an industrial arts teacher, I had a lot of time to talk to the kids while we were working on projects and things, and a lot of times it would come up about their weekend of hunting or my weekend of hunting or fishing, and I guess I always tried to promote fair chase and not, hunting from the road or shooting from your three-wheeler, which is kind of common practice sometimes. And I guess I tried to promote that the hunt was more than just the killing of the animal. And like I say, I tried to push that agenda whenever I could. And I had a pretty good-sized audience for 30 years and a lot of kids, you know, we talked about hunting and fishing, and they would look up to me and I just tried to make them, or tried to teach them to do it the right way, and that they'd enjoy it a lot more that way.
Other questions? Representative Kawasaki has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Brown, for submitting your name. I'm just curious how you became aware of this board opening.
I had a couple of friends say that they were looking for somebody from Southeast, and had a couple people from up north call me and ask me if it was something that I'd be interested in doing, and like you said, I've always been really interested in it, but just never had the time to do it, I guess, up until now. I coached and taught and had kids in school, and like I say, now that they're all not gone, I feel like I have the time that I can do that and do a good job of it.
Yeah. Other questions? Follow-up, Representative Kawasaki.
Not a follow-up, but thank you. Thank you for offering up your service, and it looks like you have a 30-year teaching at Wrangell High School, and that's certainly a good profession. I have a question. There was a bill that was recently introduced and passed the House, and it was dealing with big bull moose derbies. It's similarly like a fish derby where you catch fish. The largest fish wins. I was just curious to hear your thoughts about that particular piece of legislation that's moving its way through the Senate.
I don't know that I'm really in favor of derbies per se with big game, because it makes people do, or sometimes can make people do unruly or unlawful things to try to win a prize. And although we have a king salmon fishing derby down here, which is a very good thing, but I guess fishing's a little different than hunting. But I don't know. I don't know a lot about the moose thing there, but like you say, sometimes it can kind of promote poor sportsmanship, and when all you're looking to do is win a prize.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to mention to the committee that I've known Dave for a long time, and I think that he would be a good person to have on this board, because I've seen over the years his integrity and fairness in all situations, and I just think that he would be a good addition.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. Other questions for Mr. Brown? Good deal. Thank you, Mr. Brown. With that, we're going to set aside Mr. Brown's nomination and discussion. As I said, we'll have public testimony on all nominees at the end. So I'd next like to go to the Bethel online, where our second nominee is standing by. We have Stanley Stosh Hoffman. If you can hear me, sir, please put your name on the record and tell us why you'd like to continue service.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, sir. Mr. Hoffman, go ahead, please. Get your name on the record, though.
Okay, my name is Stanley L. Hoffman, Jr. Most people know me by the name of Stosh. I go by both names, Stosh Hoffman or Stanley Hoffman. Again, for the record, I'm from Bethel. I'm a lifelong Alaskan. I was born in Bethel, but I was raised in McGrath, which is 500 miles upriver towards the top of the Kuskokwim River in interior Alaska. And currently I reside in Bethel, where I work for the local health corporation, Yukon Kuskokwim Health Corporation. And I live here with my wife, who works for the Bethel Native Corporation, and my two sons. One is in high school and the other is in middle school. I am a commercial fisherman and a subsistence fisherman out here in the Bethel area. And also I'm a certified assistant guide. And I have a couple of small businesses I own and operate out here in Bethel as well on the side. I was first put on the Board of Game in 2008, appointed by Governor Palin, and I was again reappointed by Governor Parnell 3 years ago, so looking to do my third term. I decided to put my name in just to get on the board as a way to give back to Alaska's resource and do more for the people of Alaska and give some representation to this side of the state here. I thought there was a need for that. And I think that's pretty much the basics, and there's anything else along those lines you need, I'd be happy to give that to you.
Thank you, Mr. Hoffman. Questions from the committee? I've got one for you, sir. Just like to ask you, has your view of any particular game management issues evolved since you first joined the Board of Game? Any perspectives that have come to you during your 3 years of service to date?
Well, let's see there. Give me a second to think. I've been exposed to a lot of programs that I wasn't really familiar with. Not programs, but issues across the state. You know, kind of being over here in Bethel, I was more attuned with what's going on over here. But after getting on the board and traveling all over the state and listening to everyone, you get to learn about things that didn't really pertain to you, like deer down in the southeast is a big deal, and certain caribou herds around the state. I've learned the status of those as well. So I'm a lot more informed now, and I get a good chance to listen to a lot of different people. But as far as the question, it has. I just can't think of anything offhand right now.
Okay. Well, thank you for considering the question. If it comes back to you, we'll hear from you. Any other questions from the committee for Mr. Hoffman? Seeing none, great. We will put you aside for a short minute, Stosh, and go on to the next person also from Bethel there with you, Mr. Ted Spraker. If you can put your name in the record and present to us, remind us of your qualifications, and tell us why you want to continue service on the Board of Game.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. We can hear you. Go ahead.
Well, good afternoon, Chairman Sadler and members of the House Resources Committee. Again, for the record, my name is Ted Spraker, and I live in Soldotna. As far as a brief background, I was raised in Wyoming, where I graduated from the University in Laramie in 1971 with a bachelor's degree in wildlife management. I then entered a program, a postgraduate program at the university, and graduated the second time in 1973 with a master's degree in range management and in range science and management. My college goal, and actually even before that, was to move to Alaska and work in a wildlife management field. And I applied for several jobs, both state and federal. And I was fortunate in the spring of 1973, right after graduation, to be offered actually a couple of temporary jobs with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which brought me to Alaska. And when those jobs ended, I was hired by the Department of Fish and Game the first part of 1974 as a wildlife biologist. And I worked for the Department of Fish and Game as a wildlife biologist for the next 28 years and 4 months. And I retired in the summer of 2002. I was appointed to the Board of Game in the early part of the Governor Murkowski's administration. Then I was reappointed by Governor Palin. And I've been reappointed by Governor Parnell 3 times. So, Mr. Chairman, if I'm confirmed, this will be my 5th term on the Board of Game. I served as the vice chairman for 2 terms. I'm currently the chairman, and I've served as the chairman for the last couple years during this last term. As far as my family, I'm married. My wife is Elena. And I have to say that she's without a doubt my best supporter. She clearly understands and supports the commitment, actually, that we both have to make to be on this board and to serve and to do our best as being a good board member. And she's been a great supporter of me being on the board. We have 3 children. Our oldest son lives in Oregon, works for Intel. He's been with them about 13 or 14 years now. Our daughter is in... she's a journeyman in the 302 Union, heavy equipment operator, works primarily on the slope, and works here in South Central on road building projects. And our youngest son is a P-3 air crewman in the Navy, and he's currently on his 2nd deployment in the Middle East. And as far as, you know, the reasons why I'd like to stay on the board, you know, first, it's been an honor. And it's been a very humbling experience to have spent the past 40 years working in the wildlife management field. And like Scott says, this is, you know, this is my way of trying to do my best to give something back to conservation and to the public. You know, another reason is I've always enjoyed working with the public, and I can honestly say that public testimony is my favorite part of the Board of Game meetings. I really enjoy listening to the folks and them sharing their ideas. And one of the things I've learned with working, you know, both with the department and local advisory committees and, you know, people from around the state and so forth, is we really need to listen to all sides of an issue with the same level of respect to all individuals. And I think this has always been the, you know, the key to successful public process. And as chairman of the board, you know, this is something I hold as a mandatory duty to, of course, first consider the conservation concerns and sustainability of a wildlife resource, but very importantly, also to listen to the users. You know, another point I want to make here is I've always been and will hopefully continue to be a very strong advocate for wildlife, active wildlife management that results in healthy and sustainable populations, because I believe it benefits all users, whether you're a wildlife viewer, an avid hunter, photographer, or you're an individual that just visiting our state for a short period of time that likes to see a moose. And I think it's just very important and necessary that we engage in active wildlife management on the lands that we have in Alaska, that we can do active wildlife management. I think that's very important to the board and to the citizens and, you know, the residents of the state. And in summary, Mr. Chairman, I think that, you know, we've accomplished a lot in the four terms that I've been involved with the board process. We still have a lot of challenges ahead. You know, in general cycle, we deal with over 200 or so proposals, and I just hope to continue being part of that process. Mr. Chairman, with that, I'll close, and if there's any questions, I will certainly do my best to answer them, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Spraker. Questions for Ted Spraker? Representative Tarr, Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Spraker, for your many years of service, and I appreciated hearing you say listen to all sides of an issue. I did receive one email of someone who is speaking on opposition to the reappointment, and just want to give you an opportunity to respond to the things that were suggested in this email. And it's, I think, specific to the intensive management and active game control that you were just speaking about, and specifically about something that happened in 2011 with aerial wolf control and game management unit 15A that you pushed and were able to get through the Board of Game, even though Department of Fish and Game biologists testified that habitat was the primary factor limiting moose population growth. So if you could just give us a little bit more information on what took place there and just what I guess sort of you see the role in how you see your role in working with the department, if there are instances where the department biologist may be saying one thing is the appropriate way to address the issue, or saying that, you know, one of the issues might be different, and then when the Board of Game chooses to go in a different path.
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, that's a big question. I'll do my best. When that proposal came up, there was a lot of interest with the public because the moose population on the Kenai has declined about 75%. The number of hunters on the Kenai in the past, say in the 80s and 90s and early 2000s, averaged about 3,000 hunters. Last year, we had 425 hunters on the Kenai, so that displaced about 2,500 or so hunters to other parts of the state. And having been the area biologist here on the Kenai for about 24 years, I've had a lot of firsthand experience with dealing with moose in subunit 15A where this predator control program was implemented, and I was a very strong advocate of it. A lot of folks think that habitat alone is the key to restoring the moose population in 15A. It is clearly not the answer. Habitat has led to the decline of the population over time. When we had over 4,000 moose in 15A during the mid-80s, we had about the same number of wolves, maybe 5 to 7 packs of wolves, probably 50 or 60 total wolves in those packs. And we had less brown bears than we have now, probably about the same number of black bears. And the point I want to make is when you have 4,000 moose, that population can sustain a fairly high level of predation, or at least that level of predation. But when you have the population you have now, 15A, which is about 12 to 1,500, and the same number of predators, and actually more brown bears, then the population cannot sustain that level of predation. In my assessment of the habitat, given the Department of Fish and Game's information on 20 rates, they had 44% 20 rates in 15A in their last survey. That's indicative of a moose population that is able to grow, yet it's still declining. In my assessment overall, I realize this answer is getting long, but my assessment overall, and I think all the board members, and most of the upper-level staff at Fish and Game, maybe not some of the local folks, but all the upper-level staff, was before we worried about habitat enhancement, we really need to arrest the impacts of predation if we ever hope to grow the moose population. Representative, that's a long answer. I would be more than willing to discuss this at any time with you. It's complicated, but the basic answer is you can do all the habitat work you want in 15A. You're not going to increase moose until you increase survival of calves and adult moose. It's just not going to happen. And it's been shown many places across the state. We have 8 or 9 predator control programs going. Habitat enhancement's always one of the options. But in all the programs we have right now, we're not doing habitat enhancement to increase moose. What we're doing is trying to temporarily reduce impacts of predation.
Thank you, Mr. Spraker. Other questions from the committee? Representative Kawasaki and then Feige.
Thank you. I wasn't really going to ask the question, but because I think you answered most of it, but it's just one email from a person dealing with the issue in Unit 15A, and I don't know this to be true or false, but it does say that ADF&G biologists testified at the time that habitat was the primary factor. And so you personally, I guess, disputed that with your experience. I'd like to know under what circumstances you would under what circumstances would you ignore the Fish and Game biologists who were there in favor of basically an opposite opinion?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, I guess my near 30 years of working with the department in the last 10 plus years on the board, I've been very fortunate to look at a lot of these situations, talk with a lot of trained scientists, be involved in a lot of projects, and I feel like as a board member my job is to not always agree with Fish and Game. My job is to look at things very objectively. I listen to the public, and I've been part of this public since 1978 when I moved here to the Kenai. And I think I really understand a lot of what's going on in 15A. I'm a very avid hunter and trapper. I spend a lot of time out. And, the bottom line is we have a disagreement on the habitat issue in 15A with increase in the moose population. And I think that's proven itself because the moose population, you know, it just continues to go down year after year, although the 20 rate's high. Calf production is really high. They conducted a study on calf survival. They call it about 50 calves. And of those 50 calves, at the end of the summer, I think there was something like 7 or 8 of them left. A moose population cannot grow and sustain that level of mortality. So, again, to answer your question, my obligation is to my experience and the resource in the public, and there will be times that I will disagree with the department, and of course this isn't the first one, but you know, I do my best to be an independent thinker, and I try to be scientifically based, and that's where I'm coming from on this one.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Spraker. Question, Representative Wilson.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Spraker, I really appreciate that we've got somebody on the board with the experience that you have. On the first page of your resume, it goes into how you compiled and analyzed biological data made recommendations for regulatory changes, I'm reading here, area closures and harvest limits to assess human impact for maintenance, enhancement, and restoration of wildlife, and also had research findings for scientific journals. So obviously you have been in the area long enough and have had hands-on experience, and I think that's probably a big plus for the board itself. So I appreciate the work that you've done, and I thank you for turning around and volunteering to do this. And also, it does make a difference. All of us here, either our wives or our husbands, really have to support her, so we couldn't do the work that we do. So I appreciate that she's behind you also. Thank you for your...
Thank you very much.
Thank you. We did have a question from Representative Feige.
All right, thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, you know, this debate about, you know, predation versus habitat gets repeated all over the state on in various different ecosystems, but is there a particular metric that is sort of generally accepted for, you know, say, the number of moose calves or moose that a brown bear or any other bear for that matter can typically account for in the course of a year? I mean, I know they don't respect the tag limits or on the harvest tickets, but is there a generally accepted number, or does it vary from game management unit to game management unit?
Through the chair, Representative Feige, There are some metrics that biologists use. A generally accepted figure would be about 20 or so, 25 calves to the 100 surviving through November would be barely enough to sustain a population. If the calf-to-cow ratio builds to about 35 or 40, that's generally a level where you would realize a growth in the moose population, and if predation is less than that and calf survival is higher than that, like we see, for instance, on Calvin Island where we have no predators, you know, calf-to-cow ratios there could be 70 or even more calves to the 100 cows. You know, cows usually produce, mature cows, 3 and 4 years old and older, up to about 12 or 15 produce calves. They usually produce about 120 to 130 calves per 100 cows. So just to give you an idea of the amount of loss, and that's primarily maybe 85% higher of that is lost to predation each year. So if you're looking at some metric that will allow moose population to grow, you'd have to have a sustained calf-to-cow ratio that is probably at least above 25 per year. We have several places on the Kenai that it's far lower than that. And that's my contention about the habitat issue. There's no doubt that in the long term, if you want to really build this Kenai moose population back to what it was in the late 60s, early 70s, that we would have to have large-scale habitat enhancement. That's not a question at all. But to do habitat enhancement now without addressing the impact to predation has been the point that I have stayed with, because I just don't believe it's going to be the answer.
And follow-up?
Follow-up, Representative Feige.
And again, is there a general estimate for, you know, the number of moose that a brown bear on the Kenai would take in an individual year? Just, you know, look at it. You know, hunters are generally restricted to one if they're successful hunting. Does a brown bear take 10, 20, 100? As you adjust the brown bear population up and down, how does that affect the total number of takes on the moose population?
Through the chair, Senator Feige, I apologize for not directly answering your first question. You know, I don't know that number. I've been involved in studies where we've captured moose calves and assessed kill rates by brown bears and black bears. I know that in the early 80s we did one on black bears. Black bears killed about 45% of the calves, 11% by wolves, 11% by brown bears. The only predation rate that I am aware of, I worked on one study in Glen Allen. It wound up being about a 10-year study. There was another one on the Kenai in the late 70s. I worked on that one a little bit. Both of them came out with the same result on kill rates for wolf packs. And they made a kill, and this was a big game animal, about every 4.5 to 4.7 days. And about 75% of those, at least on the Kenai, were moose. We have about 20 to 21 packs of wolves on the Kenai. So one can do the math and realize the impact on wolves. But sir, to try to answer your question on wolves, or bears, I don't have an answer to that one. I know that when we were studying bears and watching bears in the spring, some bears were absolute moose killers. They killed adults, usually about one a week. We had adults with young, usually yearlings and 2.5-year-olds, that killed maybe one or two calves a day. They hunted calves all the time. We had other bears that never fooled with moose at all. So I'm kind of at a little bit of a loss to give you an exact metric. But I can look into that and get back with you on it. I'll try to figure that one out for you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Seeing no other questions from the committee? Good deal. Thank you, Mr. Speaker, for your comments. At this point, again, we'd like to circle back and start taking public testimony, so I will open public testimony on board of game appointments and go first to the offline for Sam Rohr in Kodiak. And Mr. Rohr, if you put your name on record and give us your comments on each of the three nominees, just make sure you delineate which is which.
Thank you, Chairman Feige, and good afternoon. My name is Sam Rohr.
Sam.
I'm the president of the Alaska Professional Hunters Association. I appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule to hear my testimony. I will be speaking briefly in support of all three nominees. And first, I'd like to speak on for Mr. Brown. APHA supports the appointment of Mr. Brown. Children truly are the future of hunting, and in that light, it is exciting to have a former teacher coming on the board of game who I am sure will keep the importance of getting kids out hunting and in the field a priority. I'm really looking forward to seeing his work on the bog. I'm not familiar with Mr. Brown other than hearing his testimony here today, but he spoke about the importance of fair chase, and he spoke about the importance of children, and I think he's going to do a good job based off of that, and I'm excited to see him in the future on the board. APHA would also support the reappointment of Mr. Hoffman. I have seen Mr. Hoffman in action during the Board of Game meetings. I've always thought he does a good job. I think he brings an important viewpoint to the board process that truly needs to be heard, and in that light, APHA supports Mr. Hoffman's reappointment to the board, and we appreciate his past effort and time he's committed to the board. APHA also strongly recommends that Ted Spraker be reappointed to the board again. Mr. Spraker is an exceptional board member who, over his many years of experience, has shown himself to be able to successfully navigate the complex and often contentious issues that the board of game process presents. He approaches the process with an open mind and is willing to weigh all sides of a proposal while carefully considering its biological and allocative implications before making a decision. Mr. Spraker has also been, in my viewpoint, an excellent chairman for the board of game. It's truly a time-consuming commitment and often one that's accompanied by little thanks. The APHA sincerely appreciates Mr. Spraker's dedication to Alaska's game resources, the various user groups, and the public process. For these reasons, it's APHA's opinion that Mr. Spraker is the right person for the job, and we highly recommend his reappointment to the Board of Game. Thank you for your consideration, for hearing my testimony, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Rohrer, for your comments on all three of those nominees. Next, we'll go off line to Fairbanks for Al Barrett.
Can you hear me, Mr. Chairman?
We can hear you now. Just make sure you give us your name and let us know who you're commenting on.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Al Barrett. I'm testifying on myself. I'm a regular attendant, as much as I can afford, to all the Board of Game meetings that I can go for the last decade at least, I'm sure. I'm neutral with Mr. Brown's confirmation. I don't know a lot about him, but through the last couple hearings and just the last fellow that testified that, you know, fair chase is something admirable, I just like to recognize that fair chase is sometimes adverse to our subsistence take. But I do support Mr. Hoffman as a board member. I've seen Mr. Hoffman. He's very approachable. He makes himself very available for discussions during the meetings. He comes prepared, and he's very knowledgeable of concerns in his area. And he's gotten a lot better. This is his third time, I guess, and so he's becoming a pretty good board member. I'm also in support of Mr. Spraker. He comes very well prepared to board of game meetings. He always wants to hear from everybody in attendance. He interacts during public testimony. He always seems to have at least one question for everybody testifying. And it's usually pertaining to something that they had in written comments or to what they had said on record. I would like to also support what his action was in 15A. And I say that because I'm on the record. It'll show that I had a proposal in at that meeting to stop predator control in there. And one thing he forgot to point out during his testimony is predator control helps protect the stocks now because habitat takes many years to grow. And so what he was trying to say is we're protecting those moose populations now for the future by giving those calves the survivability they need to get through that first year. And that predator control is not a forever thing. So as those calf survival rates go up, I'm sure the board will take action on that. I was very impressed at the last Board of Game meeting when there was non-consumptive users testifying and one or two got out of hand. I thought he handled it with the best statesman-like knowledge that he had. I was thoroughly impressed. I might have done it a different way than he did, and I just sat up when he was able to calmly calm the situation that arose out there. So, and I think as he leaves the board as chairman, there are other times that that he does. I lost my train of thought here. I lost my train of thought. So, anyways, I thought there are times as I attend the meetings and I participate in the meetings, written and orally, and to have discussions, that there are times that I disagree with them. But at any time, at the end of the day, we always enjoy a cup of coffee or a cup of tea together, and it's, you know, it's just about opinions and ideology and science, and it's all in the pool. And I think he does a very good job negotiating through that path. So I ask for the support of Mr. Hoffman and Mr. Spraker. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Brett, for your comments. Representative Tarr, you have a question for the... okay, sure, Representative Tarr.
Oh, thank you. Mr. Brett, I was just curious, with someone who's, you know, going into serving their fifth term, I know this is a pretty desirable board to serve on, and, you know, do people among, you know, supporters, do you mind when people, the same people hold the seats for many, many years, or, you know, do you if you have someone you'd like, you'd rather see that person stay on?
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, I think there's a lot of real advantage to having some members with longevity. You have the historical, none of these game management plans or you know, biology that goes on, sometimes it takes several years to see the effects of it. And so to have, you know, at least a few members on there with historical background of where you started to where you are today to where you want to be in the future is very advantageous to any board.
Good deal. Thank you, Mr. Brett. All right, going next offline, public comment to Homer for Mr. Toby Wheeler. If you can give us your name and for the record, and let us know who you're testifying on and what your position is.
Okay, my name is Toby Wheeler. I'm here in Homer, Alaska, and I thank you for the opportunity to testify before the committee today, this afternoon. I represent myself, and I would like to speak to Mr. Spraker's position on the board. I am of the opinion that the board needs to be a little bit more well-rounded and perhaps have a representative of non-consumptive users on the board. So I'm speaking for the sake of wildlife viewing, tourism, some of the other, even scientific study for some of the other non-consumptive uses of wildlife. And I realize that biology is a little bit of an inexact science, and of course there is debate about the effects of predator control versus habitat enhancement on the populations. And I guess just to sum it up, I just want to speak to the possibility of having a position on the board that's a little less aggressive, if you will, toward predator control. And Mr. Spraker obviously has a huge amount of experience and, you know, has been very qualified, obviously, as a biologist and as a conservationist. But, you know, I feel that, you know, he has a certain position on predator control, which I'm not a biologist. I'm not going to argue that. But I guess I'm just, you know, again, just to sum it up, I would like to see somebody on the Board of Game that that does have a little more, let's just say, wider view rather than just strictly hunting and trapping. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak today, and I'll go ahead and sign off.
Thank you, Mr. Wheeler. Okay, going next to Anchorage, Mr. Robert Mumford. Can you give us your name?
Yes, thank you. My name is Robert Mumford, for the record. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I'd like to go on the record as supporting all three appointees here. I'm not familiar with Dave Brown very well personally. I've never met him. I like what he has to say. I believe he could be a good, strong board member. I've worked with Stosh Hoffman quite a little bit. I am on the Board of Game with both he and Ted Spraker, and I know that Stosh is a highly respected, very articulate man from Western Alaska that it's been a real pleasure to work with on this board. He's well-reasoned in his thought processes. I know he's always brought up good points that sometimes I'm missing, and when I'm listening to testimony and, you know, I'll lean over and talk to him about things or catch him on a break and get a fresh perspective that really makes a lot of sense. And I think he's a real important person to have on this board. He does an excellent job. And with Ted Spraker, if Elena is Ted's best supporter, as he said, I'm probably his second best supporter. He's, even though I don't make the better cookies, and she does, but Ted brings this wealth of experience to the board that would be hard to get otherwise. You know, he's been on it a long time. He has the biological background, the knowledge. And as a chairman, I think Ted's one of the finest. He knows how to really bring people in, even the folks that have opposite opinions of his own, which we'll get in public testimony, and he treats them with respect. Mr. Barrett said it quite well. He knows how to diffuse a bad situation, how to bring out the best in a person, and as a board member, I'm constantly watching him and learning from him on just his approach with people, and it's real impressive. I'm extremely impressed with Ted. I can't imagine being on the board without him. So I just wanted to go on the record in supporting all three of these, but strongly in Stosh and Ted's camps.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you for your comments, Mr. Mumford. Good deal. Seeing nobody else off-site, I'd open, make sure there's anybody in the room who'd like to testify on any of these appointees of the Board of Game. Seeing and hearing none, okay, close public testimony on all three of those, and would entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair.
Unless Representative Seaton.
Thank you. I'd just like to say that I have received four detailed comments from people in my district that and the issue with Mr. Spraker seems to be the philosophically contentious issue of whether active management or predator control, whichever you want to call it, is there's two philosophies going there. And so that's been the entire I haven't received any comments really about any of the other interactions being negative or anything. So I just wanted to put that on the record that there had been some from my district. Four.
Thank you, Representative Seaton. Other discussion? Representative Olson.
I've known Ted Spraker since the early 80s. Our paths have crossed a number of times. I found him to be extremely knowledgeable and usually right in his views. We've had a difference of opinion on several occasions, but his positions are well thought out, and he puts a lot of homework into everything that he's done that I've been aware of since the early 80s.
Thank you, Representative Olson. I would observe anybody who has been able to navigate the cross currents of public policy over the range of time and administration he has must have very, very nimble feet and obviously a very strong foundation in game management. Other comments, Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you. It's just a point to make, and I respect Mr. Mumford's testimony in support of the Board of Game members that are before us. These are the ones that have come from the governor's office, and so that's why we're taking a look at them. But there's something to be said about having a board that doesn't always agree. I don't know, as the person who testified a little earlier about having some diversity on the board, I would certainly agree that we should have diversity on a rulemaking body. Thank you.
Thank you. Other discussion? Okay, I'd like a motion.
Mr. Chairman, I move to forward the names of Dave Brown, Stanley Hoffman, and Ted Spraker, their appointment to the Board of Game to a joint session for consideration. This motion does not reflect intent by any committee member to vote for or against any of these individuals during any further sessions for the purposes of confirmation.
Thank you. Any objection to the motion? Seeing none, great. We'll forward the names to the joint session, and we'll take a brief at ease to sign the confirmation sheet. 277. This is a first hearing on the bill that's an act relating to big game hunting with children.
77.
I'm sorry? 77. What did I say?
277.
I'm sorry. I apologize. House Bill 77, an act relating to big game hunting with children. So if I could have the sponsor or sponsor's staff to come forward and give us your name for the record and introduce your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Larry Simmons. I'm staff to Senator Michicki. CS for Senate Bill 77, Resources, an act relating to big game hunting with children. Before I get very far along, I'd just like to say that it's really great to be here in front of this committee. Particularly, I know that Co-Chair Feige knows exactly what it means to hunt with children. This bill was recommended to us and requested really to Senator Kelly initially, who sponsored the bill, and then it was changed to Senator Michiki. It was brought to us by Board of Game Chair Spraker, who you just heard from and is a person that we respect very highly. Since before statehood, Alaska has enjoyed a long history rich with subsistence, social and cultural benefits, as well as generational outdoor traditions derived from Alaska's hunting culture. Encouraging youth to responsibly participate and carry on Alaska's great hunting tradition and outdoor heritage is very important for youth development and quality multi-generational outdoor experience. I was pleased to hear during the previous testimony people that expressed just that the future of hunting everywhere in the United States rests largely with children. And so this bill was unanimously passed by the Senate. It has a zero fiscal note. It does two things. It gives the board more flexibility in establishing youth hunting seasons by removing the requirement to set the seasons before school starts and before the regular hunting season starts. Secondly, the bill allows a deviation from the normal requirement that on a youth hunt, both the adult and the youth's tag must be punched. In the case of Sitka black-tailed deer, where they have a one-deer limit, this bill would remove that requirement. And the idea behind that is that Sitka black-tailed deer are not large animals, and a family would then be able to take one per tag, and it would encourage the youth hunting opportunity. And Mr. Chairman, Ben Mulligan is here in the room, and Doug Vincent Lang is available, I understand, online for any questions. I'd be happy to take questions, and thank you again for considering the bill.
Thank you, Larry. Questions for the sponsor's staff, Representative Kawasaki?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm looking at the definition for adult and resident adult on the second page of the end version of the bill, and it says an adult means an individual who's 21 years of age or older. Is that the typical definition for an adult?
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, I really don't know if throughout statute in Alaska if that is a typical definition. Perhaps the department would have a good answer as to why that is defined as it is here. It's not a change in this bill.
Can I redirect the question to Doug Vincent Lang, who's on?
Absolutely. Mr. Vincent Lang, if you're online, you're now a partner of lobby with Fish and Game, you might be able to answer the question.
Well, this is Doug Vincent Lang, Representative Feige, through the chair.
Representative,
I don't know what the definition of an adult is through statute. I would imagine for voting age it's 18, but I think that has traditionally been, you know, where people are out hunting and how the board's been dealing with it is age 21. But I don't know the answer to that question. I could probably do some research and get back to you.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess, you know, for purposes of hunting and sport fishing licenses and things like that, 18 is typically considered the adult age. So that's why I'm just researching.
Okay, Doug, I think I hear you're rattling something by the microphone, so just be cautious. Question for Representative Sadler?
Oh, yeah.
Or Feige.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We sound alike.
I believe to answer Representative Kawasaki's question, at the bottom of page 1 on line 15, the last three words are in this subsection, and then that leads over to the definitions. As I read this, in this particular subsection regarding these hunts, it seems to me it was the intent of whichever legislature passed the original law, was that whoever is going to accompany the child, who would be somebody
let's see, 17, between the ages of 8 and 17, would have to be over 21. So an 18-year-old couldn't necessarily accompany a 16. Whether that, for what purpose that was, just perhaps general maturity and judgment, I'm not going to presuppose why, but that's how I'm reading this, is that they want an adult of at least 21 years to be the accompanying person, I suppose.
Okay. Other questions for the sponsor? Seeing none? Okay. I guess we'll open up public testimony. We do have one gentleman in line, so public testimony is open on SB 77. Mr. Alberette from Fairbanks, you're back with us, sir. Alberette, are you still on the line? Sorry?
He may be testifying in house judiciary right
now. Oh, okay.
I know he's bouncing back with
people. Okay. He's a big man, so we'll hold that open. Okay, seeing nobody else on the line, anybody in the room that would like to testify on SB 77? Okay. Any indication that he's coming back soon? Or?
Not yet.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Set this. Representative Seaton.
Could I ask a question to the sponsor or to the department while we're waiting?
Certainly. Representative Seaton, go ahead.
Thank you. I'm trying to figure out, with taking out of the extra season, someone that's 16 years of old and get a hunting license and go hunting in the state of Alaska, I believe, now. And I'm not sure that this is meaning if you're going out with someone who's under 17, all of a sudden, does that mean that any time you're hunting with someone who's under 17, you're going to have to both punch a harvest ticket? Because I can understand it if it's revolving around a special season, a special opening when you're going to say, okay, this is permitted, extra permitted time, but it's really the child or the youth that is doing the hunting. But if it's going to apply all year round, I think that's got greater ramifications than an extra season.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, my understanding is that the provisions of this bill only provide or are only applicable to special youth hunts that are established by the Board of Game, not the regular season as you described. So it is my understanding that it would not affect regular season and regulations.
And Mr. Chairman, could we have Doug Vincent Lang or the department
certainly
comment on that question as well?
Mr. Vincent Lang, if you're online still, can you answer the question?
Certainly, Representative Feige. Representative Seaton, through Representative Feige. What the board does is, under the statute, they create some youth hunting opportunities for parents to take, or guardians to take their kids hunting in areas that are outside the season or different than the regularly scheduled season. The way the statute was originally done, that was supposed to occur before school starts. But what's been happening in recent years is school started earlier and earlier with the expectation that kids get out earlier in the summer. But right now we're to the point where it is very hard to provide those hunting seasons early before school starts, because school's starting in some cases August 15th. So one of the big constraints that the board had in trying to establish these youth hunts according to statutes was the season starting date for school. So what this amendment is trying to, this bill is trying to do is eliminate that tying back to before school, so that you could possibly have a youth hunt either during the school session, maybe over Thanksgiving break or some other break during the session or weekend thing, so that you can provide those opportunities to pass on that hunting heritage that aren't necessarily linked to a very narrow window before school begins.
Yeah.
And to follow up, I just want to be very clear then, this would only apply to certain designated hunts, and it doesn't have the consequence of controlling non-special hunt seasons. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Representative Tarr's question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. for Mr. Vincent Lang as well, just want to understand the age designation here. Representative Seaton was saying that to get a, you need to be 16 years old to get your hunting license, and then this has it set at 17. I'm just wondering, would that be better as 16 because, or where that age cutoff is, so that because those, you know, individuals that are older than that, then they would have the opportunities through the regular, you know, bag limits to be able to get into those?
Through the chair, you know, I wasn't director when the original bill was passed where they had these ages in there. The ages aren't changing as a result of this bill. But I'm not sure why they picked 17 versus 16, where you can get a hunting license, and I'm not sure why they selected 21 versus 18, which is the, you know, an age of an adult and for voting purposes and a variety of other purposes. I think it does come back to maturity and probably the fact that when you're 17 years old, most kids are still, you know, in high school and living with their parents, and that's probably their opportunity to take them out on one of these special youth hunts. But other than that, I really don't know why they chose 21 and 17 in the original statutes. But I can tell you it hasn't been not working, or it hasn't been a constraint in trying to establish these hunts, having them with 21 years and 17 years in the statute as written.
Thank you, Mr. Vincent Lang. All right. For the record, Doug, the Representative Sabler is chairing today, but every time you call me him, he owes me dinner. So that's where dinner's. I understand Mr. Albrecht is available back in Fairbanks to testify on this bill, SB 77, Mr. Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you hear me?
We can hear you great. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Albrecht, Fairbanks resident for many years. I'm in support of this bill as it's changed. I think that, you know, removing some of the side boundaries that we had complicated our allocation issues at the Board of Game. And I think, you know, I tried very hard to just get it repealed because the Board of Game does operate and does promote children or youth hunting, and they do it through one of their allocations of heritage, you know, supporting and making wildlife resources available to all. And they also have the authority to allocate to user groups and different user groups. But as it is written, it'll work, it'll help. It's added language in the codified, but you know, there's no reason not to support this. And that's all I have for right now, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Brett. Thanks for your testimony. You're busy there. Is there anybody else either online or in person here today who'd like to testify on SB 77? Seeing none, I'll close public testimony and bring it back to the committee and see what thoughts, comments would be. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I read, I've read this a couple of times, I think basically on line 7 and 8, where it says only a resident child accompanied by a resident adult, and then it goes on to throw in or child. Why do we need that language? If you're accompanied by a resident adult, doesn't that cover everything else? Why do we need to say parent or step-parent? If you're a resident adult, why do you need to add that extra language? If the intent is it not to be a family member.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Through the chair, Representative Johnson, I'm sorry, but I don't have the answer to that. Maybe, again, asking the department that question would be better.
Okay. Mr. Vincent Lang, your perspectives.
Okay. Well, I think you have to read that as two parts. Only a resident child accompanied by a resident adult. So I could take, as a resident adult, as a resident Alaskan adult, a child that's outside my family that's a resident child on a hunt. The second one is a child accompanied by the child's resident parent, resident step-parent, or resident legal guardian. So that's saying that a child that's living outside of Alaska, if my child is living outside of Alaska, for instance, due to a divorce, I could still take that as a resident parent, that child hunting. So I think there's two different parts to that sentence, and I think they're both things that the legislature initially wanted to allow in terms of allowing either a resident child or a non-resident child to go hunting.
Thank you. Does that answer your question, Representative Johnson?
Let me read it again. Go ahead.
Okay. Other questions in the interim?
Mr.
Representative Feige.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Sadler. I think the one thing that the statute currently doesn't address is a non-resident child and a resident grandparent. Is that something we should consider adding to the bill? And that's just sort of a general question for the committee, speaking as hopefully a future grandparent.
Well, we're allowed to make amendments to bills in our committee, so certainly that would be the proper time to make the amendment. Representative Hawker, I'm Mike.
Thank you. Gosh, I don't want to get mired in this. This is a lesson in no good deed goes unpunished. But a resident child, I want to also make a point that this is existing statute that has somewhere in this legislature been debated and is on record of having reached the conclusions that are already in the statute. But a resident child accompanied by a resident adult would certainly seem to me to be encompassing and encompass a child and their grandparent. I have no idea either why we've got this other language in here, but I think my personal opinion is that statute seems to be working. I think the sponsor's intent is simply to take away the seasonal restrictions and recognize the unique circumstances of Sitka black-tailed deer, which I think would be just a really good thing without getting mired into the details of a statute that otherwise, for better or worse, is working quite well.
Thank you. Hearing no other Representative Seaton.
Mr. Chairman, as long as we have the bill before us, I recognize Representative Feige's question because I can understand that very well if I'm a grandparent and you know, I have a child that's coming up and visiting with me. Is there any reason why I, as a resident grandparent, I couldn't take that child because they're a non-resident child?
That's it.
And so
that's it.
I think that the language needs to be there, but I also agree with Representative Feige that it would be an opportune time to expand that to resident grandparent. And I think that that, because I can see many circumstances where that would be advantageous.
I can see that. One could assume that a resident legal guardian might cover some of those situations where there might be a child who lives outside but might want to take advantage of this provision to go hunting with a legal guardian could be a grandparent. But, so,
Mr. Chair, I'll also, for the record, acknowledge the merits of the conversation that just occurred here. And this gets into, isn't the word sanguinity,
co-sanguinity
that we are discussing here,
mm-hmm.
And the question is just how far, you know, to what degree do we want to talk about any blood family member?
How far we want to chase the blood?
Or then we get into the issue of step children.
Understood. Okay, we've all been warned, Representative.
Mr. Chair, step children are already covered in here. It's just the resident grandparents aren't covered.
They have their own lobby. They can come back. So, if I would entertain a motion, or we can, Representative Feige and Representative Johnson, I think, is still thinking. So, Feige.
Does Representative Johnson need more time to think?
No, I'm done. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move conceptual amendment number one to CS for Senate Bill number 77, Resources, and on line 9, after the words resident parent, insert resident grandparents. So it shall read, a child accompanied by the child's resident parent, resident grandparent, resident step-parent, etc.
Okay, we got conceptual amendment one before us. Any discussion on it? I'd like to hear the sponsors' representatives' thoughts.
No objection from Senator Michicki through his staff.
Okay. Artfully said. Good deal. Is there any objection from members of the committee to conceptual amendment one? Seeing none, conceptual amendment one is adopted. And we have SB 77 before us as amended. Further discussion on the bill? No? Okay, then I would take the motion. Representative Feige.
And Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman.
We yield. Representative Attar.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We may need to update a later part of the bill. Where on lines 14 and 15, counted against the bag limits of both the child and adult parent, step parent, or legal guardian. Do we need to add in grandparent then to that part?
Because good point.
I think that would.
I think the conceptual amendment allows some latitude for the drafters to make that adjustment as well, but that's good to point that out. So do you want to give us another amendment or just leave it to the drafters to fix it?
No, Mr. Chairman, I'll move conceptual amendment number two so that on line 14, after the word parent, you insert grandparent.
Okay.
So that it should read both the child and the adult, parent, grandparent, step-parent, or legal guardian, et cetera.
Okay. Before we finish that up, anything else might need to be?
Quick comment? Mr. Chairman.
There.
If I might also suggest that that same group of phrases occurs on line 11, or line 11, 10 and 11. Okay. So the drafter could add throughout, or you can specifically
plus that up to cover line 11.
And revised conceptual amendment number two. I would move revised conceptual amendment number two that the bill would reflect the addition of grandparents wherever applicable in the bill.
I think that's going to be conceptual amendment one to conceptual amendment two to add the words grandparent as necessary throughout the bill to reflect the intent of the mover of the amendment. Okay. Mm. Any objection to conceptual amendment one to conceptual amendment one and conceptual amendment two? Seeing none, good. Conceptual amendment two is before us. Any objection? Conceptual amendment two. Seeing none. Okay. Conceptual amendment two has been adopted. Okay. Representative Feige.
Mr. Chairman, I move the CS for Senate Bill number 7728-LS0630/November as amended with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
Any objection? Representative Kawasaki.
I'll remove my objection here very fairly shortly, but I know we're just dealing with the Fish and Game Code, dealing with the Board of Games' ability to create these hunting with youth. There's a section further down in the Fish and Game Code dealing with non-resident hunting a big game and who must accompany those folks. The language is different than this language, and I just wanted to point that to the sponsor of the bill. It's section 1605-407. And I'll withdraw my objection.
And the objection has been withdrawn. So the motion before us is movement of CS for SB 77 resources as conceptually amended. Is there objection to the motion? Seeing none, the bill passes out. And we'll take a brief at ease to sign what needs to be signed. Okay, we are back in the record at 2:29. And up next before us is Senate Bill 137. Which is the extending termination date of the Alaska Seismic Hazards Safety Commission. So if the representative from Senator Bishop's office can come and present the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Brittany Hutchison, staff to Senator Bishop.
Okay.
And in front of you today is Senate Bill 137, an act to extend the Alaska Seismic Hazards Safety Commission from June 30th, 2014 to June 30th, 2020. As most of you are probably aware, Alaska is the most seismically active region in the United States and one of the most seismically active regions in the world. And in fact, we recently surpassed the 50th anniversary of the 1964 Good Friday earthquake. And so with these, given these historical records and the inevitable potential of future activity, Alaska needs the Alaska Seismic Hazard Safety Commission. And the commission was created in 2002, and in order to help reduce the disaster potential of major earthquakes and to reduce dependence on disaster relief. They are an advisory body, and they are administered through the Department of Natural Resources and the Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys. They are comprised of 11 members, each appointed by the governor for three-year terms, and they are designed to include a cross-section of public and private representation. This commission serves all Alaskans in its work of providing goal, policy, and priority recommendations to the governor, legislature, local governments, and public and private sectors alike. They do this in order to reduce the state's vulnerability to seismic hazards and to advise them on approaches for mitigating earthquake risks and potential damage. In doing this, they are operating in the public's best interest. And for this reason and many more, Senator Bishop agrees with the audit conducted that they should be extended for a six-year term and that they are operating in the public's best interest. So with that being said, I thank you for your time and welcome your questions.
Thank you, Ms. Hutchins. Appreciate that. Committee questions for the sponsors, staff? Seeing none, okay. We do have Chris Curtis with Ledger Audit available and Steve Matreson with DNR's Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys to answer questions. I believe we have Mr. Robert Shear with the Alaska Seismic Hazards and Safety Commission online. And an indication is that Mr. Shear, you'd like to testify?
Yes, I would like to testify.
Great. So we will open public testimony on SB 137 and invite you to go ahead, Mr. Shear, and give us your name and for the record and your presentation.
Mr. Chairman and members of the House Resources Committee, my name is Robert Shear. I am the current chair of the Alaska Seismic Hazards Safety Commission. And joining you this afternoon in regards to Senate Bill 137 to extend the commission to June 30th, 2020. Excuse me. By current statutes, the commission is effectively an advisory body, as you just heard. We are charged with recommending goals and priorities to mitigating seismic hazards, which include strong ground shaking, landslides, avalanche, liquefaction, tsunami, inundation, and so on. Recommending policies for needed research, mapping, and monitoring. Reviewing practices of recovery and reconstruction after a major earthquake. And to recommend improvements to mitigate losses from similar future events. As well as just simply gathering, general gathering, analyzing, and disseminating information of general interest to the public and government. We're doing all this on behalf of the legislature, the governor, local governments, as well as the public and private sectors at large. As you heard, we are an eclectic body of volunteers, currently comprised of several geologists, the state seismologist, several civil and structural engineers, emergency responders, and the insurance industry. I myself am a professional civil engineer in geotechnical engineering. The commission believes we have and continue to function in the state's and public's best interest. As we were very pleased to learn last year at the conclusion of the Division of Legislature's audit, as they stated that in their report. Further, we are certainly looking forward to being extended for another 6 years, and I can assure the committee we already have projects underway or considered that will occupy our time for that full period. Finally, I see that the committee already has been provided the Commission's 2013 annual report, our most recent strategic plan, and two miscellaneous letters supporting Senate Bill 137. So I am sure each of you are already familiar with what the commission has accomplished in the past few years, as well as what our long-term objectives and goals are for the future. However, I would like to close with saying that the commission is always available and would welcome opportunities to assist this committee, as well as the full legislature, with any other and all matters pertaining to earthquakes and tsunamis. Thank you for your opportunity to allow me to testify today. I would be happy to answer any questions if there are any.
Thank you, Mr. Shear, for your comments. I just want to note there is a fiscal note of $10,000, so while it's a minimum fiscal note, but it's not zero. Questions for the Either the sponsor's representative or Mr. Scheer, Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Scheer, for being online. The fourth bullet point in the letter that you sent that we got via email mentions amending state regulation and departmental practices, and that also dealing specifically with new building codes. And I'm just curious how frequently that's done, and I guess whether there's current regulation dealing with building codes and seismic hazards.
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki. Yes, there are current regulations. I mean, currently, right now, the state has adopts the International Building Code, a national code that is issued every 3 years. It's referred to as a triennial code. And as of November of 2012, the state has adopted formally into statute the 2009 International Building Code, IBC. We have one policy recommendation in effect right now, and I'm just preparing a position paper that will go specifically to a couple of the departments that it affects. And then we'll be following that up with something that would require legislation down the road, but we're that's in the future. But what we're getting at is that we have adopted recently the 2009 International Building Code. The 2012 International Building Code was released, issued within months of when the state adopted the 2009 code. Now, they certainly can't be adopted very quickly or really quickly. I mean, usually there's probably going to be about a year lag or so. But one of the things we're pushing for is possibly legislation to make the adoption of the building codes more timely. Right now, we're about 4 years or so behind. You know, 2012 won't come up to be reviewed and looked at probably until 2015 or later. So that's one of the things we're striving for, because these building codes, while you may hear the word 2012 International Building Code, it is based on the state of practice that is probably by that time 6 to 8 years old. You know, we're not talking about changes that just occurred in 2012. These are in the engineering world and building and construction materials world are things that are reflecting things that are much older. Now, I think one of the dots that you're talking to in the letter was more specific to the 2012 International Building Code has a number of issues in our field relative to the designing for seismic forces and to be more resilient in a seismic environment. There were some pretty major changes between the 2009 code and the 2012 code that are particularly applicable in Alaska. So what we're trying to do is, and what I'm getting ready to send out here, we are shortly, within the next month or so, to like the Department of Education, Early Development, Department of Transportation, that public schools, public buildings that we are now getting ready to start design of, that we use the 2012 seismic provisions within the context of the 2009 code. That's the kind of gist of, I guess, what that bullet item meant.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Scheer, for that thorough answer. Okay, Representative Tara.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one quick question. Because the anniversary just happened a few days ago, there were many activities planned throughout the state in, you know, for emergency preparedness in response to that. And I'm just wondering if you all participated in those, and if you have any comments. Of course, we were mostly here, so weren't able to participate in those events. And, you know, should we be thinking about doing more coordinated community-wide training type of events like that in the future?
Through the Chair, Representative Tarr, that is an excellent question. I do not have an answer for you right now other than to say in a generic sense, yes. We have our next meeting is, the commission is scheduled for April 21st and 22nd. It'll be a two-day meeting. We call face-to-face meetings. We only meet a couple of times a year face-to-face. We meet more regularly, but teleconference-wise. Several members of the commission were directly involved, not just as observers, but were on the ground in all of those exercises that happened on March 27th, preparing for them and so on. And those folks will be filling the commission in. We've dedicated them out of our meeting agenda to that very subject and trying to get feedback from those people that participated in it directly and then come back out with, I guess, our findings or recommendations or conclusions from it that we would then follow up and send out. So I can't answer it right now, but I can assure you it's on our agenda for the meeting in a couple of weeks.
Yeah. Thank you, Sheriff. Thank you. It's my intention to leave some time for presentation of the next bill, so with that, I'd ask if there are any other committee questions. Very good. Thank you very much, Mr. Shearer. Anybody else locally who'd like to testify? All right, with that, we'll close public testimony on this bill and ask the will of the committee. Representative Feige.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move Senate Bill number 137-28-LS1318/alpha with attached fiscal note and individual recommendations.
Objection? Seeing none, the bill passes out of committee. We'll pause very briefly for Nadia to sign the report. Okay, we're back in the record at 18 until 3 o'clock. In the interest of time, we're going to keep signing as we go. I want to bring up the last measure, House Bill 371, and this is our first hearing on this bill in this committee. It's my intent to have the sponsor introduce the bill, adopt a CS, and to let the committee take questions and possibly get some public testimony, but hold the bill over. So with that, we'll keep signing and ask Ms. Bloor to introduce herself to the record. Who do you want to present?
Well, I'll have my chief of staff introduce the bill, and it's actually a bill from the Department of from DOT and from the Department of Resources, so Natural Resources. So they'll come up and explain it after Becky gives us.
Okay, great. Thank you, Representative Wilson. So with that, Becky, if you'll put yourself on the record and start off the parade.
For the record, I'm Becky Rooney, staff to Representative Peggy Wilson, District 33. We intended a CS. Do you have that before you, or do you want to talk to that first? Or?
Let's do that first.
I'm sorry, ma'am. Could you say it again, please?
We had intended to start with our CS. Is that possible?
We could do that. Okay. I would take a motion to introduce this to CS as working document. Representative Feige.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we adopt the CS for House Bill number 371-28-LS1545-O as the working document.
Okay, we have CS version O before us. Any objection? Okay. Same objection is for... Okay, good. Okay, we have version O before us. Go ahead, Becky.
Okay, by explanation of what is changed in the CS, we received a letter from the North Slope Borough stating that portions of the Happy Valley and Franklin Bluff sites were part of the land selected by the borough for conveyance as part of the borough's entitlement. So that section has been totally removed, which was Section 15. And DOT and DNR did not want this bill to hold up their selection. HB 379 was introduced at the request of DOT and DNR. It is a collaboration between the two departments to reduce ambiguity and streamline rights-of-way processes between these two departments. HB 371 is a no-cost solution that will save time and resources for transportation projects. In addition, it will also eliminate contracting requirements between DOT and DNR when accessing road materials for transportation projects. There will be a reciprocal removal of the 55-year lease limit on U.S. Forest Service transportation easements and DNR's log transfer easements. Now, we have the experts from DOT and DNR here that can really go into the details of the bill and answer your questions, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Good deal. With that, department up next to give us the details. And thank you for your patience and indulging the other business of the committee.
We just want to thank the committee for hearing this bill today. My name is Kim Rice for the record. I'm the Deputy Commissioner at DOT. To my left is the Division Ops Manager at DNR, Wynn Menifee, and to my right is John Bennett. right-of-way chief in Fairbanks, the Northern Region, and Sean Lynch is assistant AG who helped write the bill. And as Becky said, the purpose of the bill is really, it's a relationship issue kind of between DOT and DNR and how we do land processes and overlap that occurs between us. So it's really between two state agencies. One point is to streamline project delivery by removing some duplicate process, what we believe is duplicate process. The second is to improve the process of disposing excess right-of-way to adjoining property owners. And the third purpose is to reduce bureaucracy for managing state-managed material sites. And as was mentioned, we did ask for the Section 15 on the North Slope to be removed from the bill, and we have not withdrawn our application as far as using those two sites, Franklin Bluffs and Happy Valley, for maintenance for and development of gas resources. But we'll just wait for the processes to work itself out between the three agencies. We have been trying diligently to respond to all of the comments that have come in from the public, and we're hoping that as we work through this process that we make clarifications and changes that's been requested. So at this point, I can go in more detail of parts over the bill, or we can just start with questions. What would be the will of the committee?
Not seeing a lot of questions so far, so I would say take advantage of the time you have to make your full presentation.
So the first section, which is sections 3, 5, and 8, they're duplicate processes because we have the facility section, the aviation section, and the highway section of the law, and so they're duplicate, is to get what we believe is not necessary of multiple use analysis for single government purpose lands and replace it with replace the DNR decision process with the DOT determination and public notice, and using engineering judgment and public involvement when we develop projects. So in your packet, there is, and I'm going to try to keep this brief, there's a project development process flow chart, which describes how we go about dealing with agencies through NEPA and the public. And people are under the misperception that NEPA doesn't happen on all state projects. But if you have a single wetland on your project, you have a core permit and you have NEPA. If you hit an archaeological site, you have NEPA. So if there's anything outside of perhaps paving on the top of the existing surface, you're going to have a NEPA guidance document that you're going to have to do for the federal government. And that process dictates pretty much our public involvement process. It can be anything from a checklist, like the Corps checklist, where you go through a list of agencies, and we have an abbreviated list on the left-hand corner of the page. We go through a checklist and make sure that we have addressed or approached all of the agencies that could have an interest. It could be a checklist or it could be an EIS, and it could take 10 years. But as you look along this top of this, you'll see the orange balloons. The orange balloons tell you where we have public involvement process before we ever really start an engineering project. So that's the first three sections of the bill that we're altering. And the purpose of actually showing you this NEPA, this flow chart for project development, is to make to rest assured that we are not throwing away public process. We're just saying it should be done earlier in the project development process.
Mr. Bennett.
Yes, thank you. For the record, John Bennett, Northern Region Right-of-Way Chief. And I was going to speak a little bit to the provisions that modify our disposal statutes. And as the right-of-way chief and working in the right-of-way section of Northern Region for the last 28 years, I can tell you that some of the language that exists in the disposal statutes has been difficult to work with, confusing at best. And we hope to provide language that is uniform across all three of our authorities for aviation, highways, and public facilities that will go to solve some of these problems. Now, in the provisions in sections 2, 4, and 10, one provision states that where currently any land that is received from DNR, when it is determined to be excess to the department's needs, it shall be returned to DNR. Now, We've replaced that with essentially a first right of refusal. That is, when it's been determined to be excess of the department's needs, we will coordinate with DNR, and if they then request that that land be returned to them, that's the first thing that we must do. But then if they don't request to be returned to them, it gives us some other opportunities to assist some adjoining property owners where we've had problems before. One of the issues we brought up in the hearings before was a case out on the Glen Highway, the Eureka Lodge, where they accidentally built sewage lagoons within the Glen Highway right-of-way. We tried to resolve their problem, but we only have a highway easement that DOT manages. We could vacate that. However, then the underlying fee is owned by DNR, and they found that under their preference right sales statutes, they could not resolve that problem. So we have essentially an unresolvable disposal issue that this adjoining property owner just cannot be helped. Under this new language, by virtue of the fact that DOT will now have fee title to the surface estate of our transportation facilities, and the fact that it doesn't have to go back to DNR, we could actually do a disposal to the adjoiner and solve this problem with those sewage lagoons. Another problem we have is in our AS35, or public facilities statutes, that actually has language in it that says that if land is determined to be excess to the department's needs, it must go back to the owner that it was vested in at the time of the taking. And the problem what we ran into there was we would end up with situations, say for example, our example is Fort Yukon, where we acquired a total piece of property for trooper housing. The trooper housing is the troopers have left. It's no longer necessary for them. The community has been using the site as a health care clinic. They desired to purchase it from DOT, only we found that under this statutory provision, we could not sell it to them. The original owner is nowhere to be found, so that's another one of our unresolvable disposal issues that we believe the modification in the language and the uniform provisions would allow us to resolve. I think I'll stop right there, and if there are any questions, I could work.
Seeing none?
Mr. Lynch. The Department of Law, and there are actually two different provisions that I'm going to touch on real quick. One is in sections 1, 6, and 9, and again, these provisions repeat themselves three times to fit with the airport authorities, highway authorities, public facility authorities. This section, what it does is puts DOT in the primary regulatory position on its highway rights-of-way. Right now, DOT has full authority over its rights-of-way, but DNR has full unfettered authority over state land. Since rights-of-way are a subset of state land, we get these overlapping authorities. I can just, as a note, all of these provisions address that exact problem where we have these overlapping in state law, both agencies have full unfettered authority, and so we got to figure out who's on first. So that's what each one of these sections just says. DOT is the primary authority on the right to within the rights of way limit, and DNR still exercises their full regulatory authority upon the conditions of DOT. So to protect the traveling public and the state's infrastructure, DOT can limit, say, a mining permit. It can't go under the highway. I would imagine that would be DOT's discretion, but that's the intent. And the last is on material sales, and we have the same type of issue. This is section 13. It exempts, it's an amendment to DNR's Alaska Lands Act. Broadens the existing exemptions, the DOT exemptions in 3805030. The DOT would be exempt from DNR's material sales contract requirements. And so what happens here is DOT will open a permit, will open a material site, have the environmental permits, and use the site. It's DOT's site. But DNR has the full authority to sell materials from state-owned material sites. since DOT's material sites are state-owned material sites. Under the existing laws, DOT must go to DNR for a material sales contract to extract materials from a state-owned site. And so this just exempts DOT from that contracting requirement. DNR still has their untouched full authority to issue material sales contracts to third parties, municipalities, to issue material sales contracts on state land. It's just a DOT exemption. That's Section 13. And
to that point, Mr. Lynch, does that mean that DOT would have to declare that the further use of that material is surplus to DOT's needs, and therefore DNR could then sell to the public, or what?
No, actually, the third-party sales are under, it's an Alaska Lands Act standard, so DNR, who makes the sale, makes the sale on it's the best interest of the state determination, and DNR has made findings. They have a list of over 500 sites that they've determined. It's the set list of material sales can be done from those 500 sites or 500 and some, and it's in the best interest of the state. So DOT is completely outside of the third-party sales. They're completely outside. The agencies still coordinate. You know, when you have a DOT active pit and DNR has third-party sales, the two agencies really have to coordinate with each other on where the third party person gets their materials, which part of the pit, environmental compliance, since DOT has the environmental permits for the pit.
Actually, just to that line before we go to wind, I read the sponsor statement. Something stuck out that said, since the improvements for highways, public facilities, and roadways have been funded by the legislature, these transfers are presumed to be in the public's interest. Does this mean there's no best interest findings in these kind of cases? Or are there other examples, and other examples, where there's legislative appropriation is an excuse for not going through a best interest finding?
Representative Senator, I can...
This is Mr. Lynch.
This is sections... In the acquisition, land acquisition sections, sections 3, 5, and 8, if DOT requires public domain for a project, so this is the, as this comes up, it would be the legislature has a project in the capital budget that the... Under this legislation, and I'm looking at Section 5, there are two statements that are in the legislation. One is the transfer of public domain from DNR to DOT is not a disposal of state land. It is not leaving state ownership, so this bill would clarify that. It is a it changes the color of title, but it's not a disposal of state land. And the second is that transfer is presumed to be in the public interest.
So the best interest is kind of built right in.
That is correct. That the best interest and that there is no best interest finding needed under Alaska Lands Act when state land is appropriated for a state infrastructure project.
And do you know, again, second part of my question, are there other examples in state law where that appropriation or where there's that kind of language that says this is actually is going to be presumed to be in the state's interests, absence of BIF?
Representative Sadler, I know of examples where other state agencies are exempted from the Alaska Lands Act. The Alaska Lands Act exempts University of Alaska, the Alaska Railroad. Mental Health Trust has a limited exemption. So these best interest findings in the Alaska Lands Act findings are not needed for those agencies. But being unfamiliar with their specific statutes, I don't know how they read. But they are exempted from the best interest.
Thank you. Two more questions. I'm sorry, Mr. Mr. Menifee, I'd like to give us your presentation.
Wynn Menifee, Chief Operations for Division of Mine, Land and Water. I'm not actually going to provide any testimony. I was going to help answer the Section 13 question in but if you're satisfied with that, I don't need to go into that.
Okay. Ma'am. Questions for our, unless you have anything else to add, we got a couple minutes for committee questions. Representative Tarr.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, just on this Section 13, I guess I would be interested in what you, were you, you felt like you were going to say the same exact things, or was there additional perspective? I'm just wondering if there's something we might not have thought of.
Representative Tarr, through the chair. The point that I was going to add just was clarification that Section 13 is different from these previous sections because the previous sections, Sections 1, 6, and 9, are about recognizing DOT's primary authority on lands needed for the airport's facilities and rights-of-way. Sections 3, 5, and 8 are transferring lands that they declare they need. Section 13 is we have a source of many other material sites that are not managed by DOT that they would have the liberty to go in and obtain materials free of a contract, free of charge. And it's in those when the question came up is how would you deal with that? The really the question comes in that it says that we cannot put any constraints on it. It really is up to DOT to figure out what they really need out of those pits because we would manage them for some other purpose, whether it's some gravel company that had asked for that gravel pit or whatever. But if DOT then comes in and uses material, you would have to adjust perhaps that contract depending on what DOT needs.
Other questions, Representative Tarr?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And where would we see that in the budget? Because right now those would be, you know, DNR would have some kind of authority to, for those third-party sales to take place. And so there'd be some reduction in revenue, I guess, if there were, you know, if the materials were being used by DOT, would it be an interagency relationship, a program? I guess it's not a program receipts, but an interagency transfer. Is that how that would work?
Representative Tarr, through the chair, if materials were used by DOT, there would be no charge. There would be no transfer of monies. Mm-hmm. Right now, what DOT pays is an administrative processing fee of 50 cents per cubic yard to cover the administrative costs for doing a material sale contract and creating a pit. But the but under this scenario, under this bill, there would be no transfer of those funds between DOT and DNR.
Representative Tarr through the chair. But that's because there's no contract being written. Mm-hmm. So those administrative fees are to cover the contracting costs. And also we would be consulting with DNR would consult with us when they do material sales to see what's available. And they would limit their material sales based on that. However, once a contract is let with a third party, they certainly have a right, and we couldn't take from them what they have because that would be unconstitutional.
Mm-hmm. And for the record, that's Deputy Commissioner Rice. I just want to make sure. Mr. Bennett?
Representative Sadler, there. I was going to speak just for a moment to some concerns that we had heard with regard to Sections 3, 5, and 8, that the process by which we acquire these new properties from DNR for our projects. And the thought was that by eliminating DNR from that process where they go through a decision-making process and a public notice, that we were reducing our transparency, if you will, to the public as to how these transactions are being made. And we wanted to state that in the bill itself, it says that DOT is going to make a determination and its base and reach a conclusion that these lands are reasonably necessary and that we are adding another point of public notice to the process. So if you look at what is being lost from the DNR process and what's being added to the DOT process, there's really going to be no net loss of public involvement or public notice. And we also, if you do reflect on our chart there on our public process for our projects, the public involvement, the public notice, it is extensive. It varies depending on the complexity of the project, but by the time we've waded through all of these processes, there has been an awful lot of contact with the public.
Good deal. Thank you. With that, ladies and gentlemen, it's about 5 minutes after 3 o'clock, and I apologize for the clock running out on us, so we're going to hold this bill over for a future time, and my apologies to Rod Arno and Dick Milius. We'll hope we can have a chance to do public testimony later on. So with that, we will hold the bill, and we will recess House Resources Committee to a call the chair, most likely Tuesday, 8 a.m. We are adjourned at 3:05.